chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, has expressed confidence in the U.S. economy and optimism about its future. But not everyone feels that way. Despite Dodd-Frank being written into law in 2010, many U.S. financial institutions are engaging in risky behavior, eerily similar to those seen in the lead-up to the 2008 financial crisis. In fact, four of the U.S. largest banking institutions are currently exploiting a loophole in the law to avoid regulating some of their trading. A recent paper published by the Institute for New Economic Thinking titled "Too Big to Fail Banks: Regulatory Alchemy" looks at the financial structures that caused the 2008 crisis and how the same risky trading practices are being used today. Here to explain the paper and what the U.S. needs to do to avoid repeating recent history is the paper's author and professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law, Michael Greenberger. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So first off, let's start very basic with derivatives. What are we talking about?
Well, I don't want to lose people with technical language. And for purposes of my concerns, we're talking about essentially making bets or trying to ensure indebtedness that is not owed to you. For example, if I decided I thought someone in my community was very sick, I can't go and get a life insurance policy on their life. That's not permitted. But in 2006, 2007, very shrewd investors, as made popular by Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, were able to take bets on whether mortgages they did not own would fail. So essentially, they got insurances against the failure of mortgages they did not own. It was like going to a baseball game and placing a bet on some team you do not own, whether they would win or lose. And they bet trillions of dollars that mortgages would fail. They were successful in those bets. And when the bets came due, the banks didn't have capital reserves to pay them off. If that had remained the way it was, the inability of banks to pay off trillions of dollars of obligations, we would have had the second Great Depression. And the United States taxpayer came to the rescue. They provided trillion-dollar bailouts to U.S. banks so that they could pay off those bets, so that they could not fail, and that there would not be a worldwide economic calamity.
Okay, what you're talking about, so is that's a recap of what led us up to the last financial crash, correct?
Right.
So where
and essentially, to be clear, the derivatives, to use a technical term, in that scenario, were people's ability to insure against losses on mortgages they did not own. It was technically called a naked credit default swap, but that terminology sort of blinds you to what was really happening.
Okay, so moving on, though, I want you to define somewhat briefly for me, if that's possible, what an over-the-counter swap is.
Well, in the scenario that I outlined, the swap is better on the failure to pay mortgages has one end of a bet, which they swap with the bank, who takes the position of the people who are making the loans or giving the mortgages. A more classic kind of swap is I take out a loan. I have an adjustable interest rate. I don't know what the interest rate is going to be over a period of years. The bank comes to me with the offer of a swap. They will take the risk of the adjustable interest if you pay them a fixed interest rate over a set period of time. So they've swapped the risk. The bank is taking the risk of the adjustments. The person who has the loan is mitigating that risk by making a fixed payment to the bank. So you've swapped a adjustable interest rate obligation for a fixed interest rate obligation.
Okay, so then with that in mind, tell us about what the difference is, because we're not talking about mortgage debt this time. We're talking about a different kind of debt, three specifically, right?
Yes. Well, actually, as time has gone on, even in the short period since my paper was published in June, there are additional kinds of debts. But when I published the paper, there were three kinds of debts in the financial environment that were beginning to cause trouble. One is student loan debt, as students take out loans, paying 6% or so interest to pay off tuition. The defaults on those loans are starting to escalate in a way that reminds you of 2006, 2007 with mortgage debts. The second kind of loan is an auto loan debt, and debts on auto loans are defaulting at escalating rates, just like mortgage defaults were happening in 2006, 2007. The third is credit card debt, and the same thing is happening. People are unable to pay back their credit card debt, and that is escalating, again, the way the mortgage debts escalated in 2006, 2007. In the last month or so, there have been very big reports, prominent reports, one in the New York Times, one in the Washington Post, that corporations borrowed a lot of money to be able to buy back their stock, to be able to drive the stock price up. And you're starting to see, as interest rates begin to rise, there is a very big worry that these corporations will not be able to pay off the debt that they incurred to buy back their stock. And we're talking, when you add all that up, you're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars of indebtedness across those four kinds of markets that approach the kind of indebtedness we faced in 2007, 2008 with the defaults on mortgages.
All right, so what are the most glaring warning signs to you that you're seeing right now?
Well, it's twofold. One, we are, and the Wall Street Journal and others have called this to our attention, we're seeing increasing defaults to the tune of trillions of dollars. Now it's on consumer debt or this corporate debt. In 2006, 2007, it was on mortgage debt. The thing that is important about this, though, is that it is not just the debt that's causing the alarm, because we're seeing the very same kind of speculative activity surrounding that debt that we saw in 2006, 2007.
And that's what seems to stand out to me in your paper, that even though the debt is different, some of the same financial engineering instruments are being used to, I guess, game the system, if that's
exactly
the right phrasing.
Exactly. And the most frightening part of it is that people are, again, betting that the debt will not pay it off, even though they are not the parties that extended the debt. Just to give you an example, in the case of mortgages, everybody thought, oh, the problem is people can't pay off their mortgages. But people bet as much as nine times on each mortgage that it wouldn't be paid off. So if there was a default, it wasn't the actual mortgage that caused the financial shortfall. It was the inability to pay off the nine different bets on whether that mortgage would succeed or not. So writ large across the economy, my view is if there hadn't been these side bets to the tune of trillions of dollars in the mortgages and we only had mortgage defaults, it would have been a problem, but nowhere near the kind of great recession problem that we face.
So this seems like the natural place, though, to come in and ask, what was it that Dodd-Frank was supposed to do? I mean, this was supposed to be the legislation that was going to save us.
That's a great question and well-timed. Because what Dodd-Frank essentially said is, if you're going to make these kinds of bets, either side, you must set aside capital reserves. So when the judgment day occurs, you have an ability to pay the debts off. Again, going back to things like casinos can't take bets without under state gambling laws without having reserves to assure that those bets would be paid. But even more important was, prior to Dodd-Frank, these bets were all private, unilateral bets that only the bettors knew about, and the bettors didn't know about each other's bets. What Dodd-Frank said is this whole financial structure has to be transparent to the regulators, so they see as these things are building up, they can intervene and stop the madness.
Wasn't some of the other part also to prevent the U.S. taxpayers from having to be the ones on the hook for when these debts go bad?
That was purpose number one in the passage of Dodd-Frank. The first purpose Congress laid out is we are not going to have taxpayers bail out people who have been ridiculously speculative and put them back in the wonderful position they were in before the calamity happened. And as part of that, they said, we're not going to have the taxpayers serve as the bank of last lender of last resort for the gamblers. The gamblers have to have their own set-asides, like a casino has, to ensure that when judgment day comes, there's money there to pay things off. And number two, just like a casino, there are state regulators who see what's happening, and if things become of danger to the economy, things are called to a halt. And that's what Dodd-Frank was designed to do, to prevent that gambling scenario from reoccurring. And the banks, unfortunately, and the Trump administration is standing by, almost applauding, have found a way to escape Dodd-Frank.
Now, when you talk about these banks, just for clarification here, because you do lay them out in your piece, who are the main U.S. financial players that we're talking about in these markets?
When we talk about what we call the swaps market, there are four banks that have 90% of the market. They're Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase. So we're not talking about every bank. We're talking about these banks. Now, these banks are what are called systemically risky banks. They've been declared the kind of financial institution that if they collapse, they've been declared, by the way, under Dodd-Frank, that they're big enough and dangerous enough that if they collapse, they could cause another great recession. And therefore, all kinds of protections have put in place to prevent the taxpayers from being called upon to the tune of trillions of dollars to bail these big banks out.
There's a lot. Obviously, there's so much more to this that we're going to be getting to. But also, aren't these banks main global financial players as well? They're not just U.S. banks.
No, absolutely. There are global financial players, but if they fail, it will be the U.S. taxpayer because they're headquartered in the United States, their principal place of business is the United States, they're chartered in the United States, they're supervised by United States bank regulators. And as was true both before the recession and after the recession, these banks have had foreign institutions that have gotten into serious trouble. Before the recession was AIG's financial products subsidiary that was taking these bets, and they almost brought down AIG, and we stopped that by U.S. taxpayer bailouts to the tune of $160 billion to keep AIG afloat. And there have been other calamities that have taken place outside the United States, but by United States institutions.
All right. And so in your paper, you were writing that these institutions have all been labeled systemically important under Dodd-Frank by the U.S. Financial Stability Oversight Board, meaning that another financial meltdown would almost certainly mean that they would need to be bailed out. But very quickly, can you explain how these institutions' stock valuations have been bolstered by this near guarantee that the taxpayer would bail them out?
Well, because people have observed what happened in 2008. They all ran into trouble. They all came to the point of near failure. Their near failure would have sent a financial shockwave around the world. So essentially, the Financial Stability Oversight Council was asked to pick out financial institutions, and they're mostly big banks like these four, that if they fail, there would be a calamity. And the entire structure of Dodd-Frank, beyond even the things I'm talking about, are designed to prevent our what are called too-big-to-fail institutions to collapse. Well, they didn't collapse, and they've been labeled too-big-to-fail. So people who want to buy their stock, for example, they know that these banks are unlikely to go through bankruptcy or anything akin to it. Why? Because the U.S. taxpayer, they think, will bail those banks out. So there's a premium. There have been financial studies made.
Okay, we're going to hold it right there very quickly. Okay. I just want to reintroduce and say that I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I'm speaking with Professor Michael Greenberger about his recent paper, Too Big to Fail, Banks, Regulatory Alchemy. Okay, so Professor Greenberger, one of the things that we left off with was talking about the swaps of derivatives, but now I want to get into what it is that makes these swaps so risky to the financial institutions.
Well, basically the swaps are written in a way that historically have proven that the non-bank dealer, the person who enters into the swap, often gets into a situation where the where he or she or it are unable to pay the swap back. And that has led, leaving aside things that lead you into something like the Great Recession, it has led to the bankruptcy of a lot of prominent institutions who get caught up in their inability to pay the banks on the swap transaction. And the classic examples of the city of Detroit, the city of Birmingham, the California University school system, the Pennsylvania school system, all those systems entered into swaps that were really one-way transactions. They got taken to the cleaners by the banks in the transactions. They couldn't pay the amount they owed the bank under the swap. And the way those swaps work is if you default on one payment and you can't make the rest of your payments, say the swap lasts for 30 years, the bank accelerates 30 years worth of damages and includes a liquidated damage penalty of several million dollars. And you end up, say you were, I was an expert witness for one cement manufacturer who had owed banks under the swap $6 million, but when the amounts were accelerated and the liquidated damage penalty was assessed, they owed $60 million.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, how on earth did we get here? Like, this sounds incredibly deregulated.
Well, before the... I spent 2 years in the federal government working with a wonderful woman named Brooks Lee Bourne, who was chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, under which these swaps are supposed to be run. And we spent a two-year period from 98 to 2000 trying to get these swaps regulated so that they wouldn't bite in that way. They wouldn't bring the economy down. And it was a battle that we lost. We came up against Larry Summers, Bob Rubin, Alan Greenspan, who were backed, not in a knowing way, by the president, President Clinton. And by December 15, 2000, this entire market, by legislation, in a single day, legislation was passed to deregulate these transactions from virtually every kind of law in existence.
And did any of these people give any reason for why it was necessary to provide this much deregulation?
Because banks and business people know what they're doing. They should be left to act on their own devices. People like stupid regulators such as myself don't understand how these things work. These are people who are too smart to get themselves or anybody else in trouble. That was the thinking in 2000. By 2008, we saw that was wrong. They got themselves, not only did they get themselves in trouble, they got the world in trouble. And the aggravating factor is, with the U.S. taxpayer bailouts, the average U.S. taxpayer bailed these guys out, and they're richer, stronger, bigger now than they ever were. And even those banks that failed, the CEOs, like the CEO of Lehman Brothers, owns four different mansions around the United States. The only people that got hurt in the end were the average Joe, who pays his or her taxes.
Well, so all of this, of course, seems to be predicated, according to your paper, on everybody's favorite legal term, the loophole. So can you explain to us what the loophole is in the Dodd-Frank bill that allowed for this to recreate itself, for this financial risky trading to rear its head?
Yes. Well, when by the way, in Congress, when Dodd-Frank passed, there was 59 or 60 Democratic senators. It would have never passed if the Republicans had more than 41 or 42 senators. No Republican voted for Dodd-Frank, or if they did, there were one or two. Be that as it may, when the bill passed, the drafters, both in the House and the Senate, said, hey, these banks are worldwide. They're going to do swaps outside the United States. And they set out a rule that said when the swaps were done outside the United States, if they had the possibility of causing harm to the United States economy, Dodd-Frank would apply. And the agency that implemented that, Commodities Future Trading Commission, said, well, certainly if the swap is transacted through a foreign subsidiary that is guaranteed by a U.S. bank holding company. What I mean by guaranteed is you tell people you're doing business with, if this subsidiary fails, the bank holding company, the big money machine, will stand behind it. If that's the case, if these foreign subsidiaries are guaranteed, Dodd-Frank applies. Simple rule. That was promulgated on July 2013.
But that's not the loophole, right?
No, but I'm going to explain that.
Okay.
On August 2014, under cover of darkness, the people of the Association of the Swap Dealers said quietly among themselves, let's de-guarantee all our foreign subsidiaries. If they're de-guaranteed, Dodd-Frank doesn't apply. So without telling anyone, they de-guaranteed hundreds of foreign subsidiaries that had been guaranteed, and then they sent all their swaps transactions from the United States to those foreign de-guaranteed subsidiaries, and voila, Dodd-Frank didn't apply. I should add quickly that the Obama administration caught on to that. In October 2016, they proposed a rule to stop it, but that takes time to get a rule into place. Trump got elected, and the Trump administration has no interest in fixing this problem.
All right. I'm speaking with Professor Michael Greenberger about his recent paper, Too Big to Fail Banks, Regulatory Alchemy. So this loophole that we're talking about, isn't this based on, under the cover of darkness that you were saying, a single footnote out of 662?
The guiding paper on this was 80 pages long. It had 662 footnotes. It was promulgated by the CFTC.
Do you know what the footnote says?
The footnote is gobbledygook. It uses the words guarantee and de-guarantee. But the banks said, we look at this footnote. We think if a bank is de-guaranteed, it's out of Dodd-Frank. It's footnote 563 of 662 footnotes. And they said, guys, de-guarantee all your subsidiaries. And hundreds of subsidiaries were de-guaranteed. Swaps were run through them, and now they're no longer regulated by Dodd-Frank. This happened in August of 2014. They discovered it. They tried to fix it, but they couldn't get the fix done before Trump became president.
Okay, but while all of this is happening, something called the De-Guarantee User's Guide came into existence.
Well, that the User's Guide, that's a term I use to say that the Association of Swap Dealers laid out a strategy for each bank to de-guarantee its foreign subsidiaries. They essentially wrote a paragraph and said, stick this paragraph into your swaps agreements. It had a check mark on it. Check the box, and you can now use your foreign subsidiaries to evade Dodd-Frank. Now, we even found out, and the CFTC found out, they were executing the swaps on Wall Street. They were negotiated on Wall Street, signed on Wall Street, executed on Wall Street, then sent off to a foreign de-guaranteed subsidiary, and the banks claimed they're no longer regulated. Obama's people tried to stop it. Trump's people don't want to stop it. And we have trillions of dollars in swaps that used to be under the flag of the United States that are now deemed to be British or German or what have you. But bear this in mind, while the swaps have gone abroad, the lender of last resort remains in the United States. If any of these subsidiaries fall apart, and that falling apart jeopardizes Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase et al., and those banks get into trouble, the British taxpayers aren't going to save them. The German taxpayers aren't going to save them. We're going to turn square corners and face the claim, okay, our banks are in trouble. If we don't rescue them, we're going to have the second Great Depression. Pony up trillions of dollars in taxpayer money, and let's bail these guys out.
Okay, all right. So now I have to ask, when does or where does the Commodity Futures Trading Commission come in? Because shouldn't they have noticed this? And if they did, when?
Well, that's an excellent question. And because it was done without announcing that it was being done, the banks quietly did all this. Suddenly, people started to see that the quantity of U.S. swaps was declining while the quantity of swaps abroad was increasing, and they figured out and found out about this de-guarantee strategy. By the time they caught up with it, it was October 2016, and they proposed a rule that said, hey, this is absurd. We're not going to do this anymore. If the subsidiary's finances are on the books of the holding company, they're covered by Dodd-Frank. Now, when you propose a rule, it usually takes about a year to go through all the procedural loopholes to finalize it. They proposed it in October of 2016. Obviously, like many of us, never thinking that we would have a Trump presidency. They didn't finish it by January 20th, and it will not be finished by the Trump administration, nor will it be fixed by a Republican Congress. But there is an avenue of relief.
So what percentage of these swaps are going through this loophole?
There are reliable estimates. There are, as I've explained, there are different kinds of swaps, but some of the swaps entities, as many as 95%, have moved from the United States to abroad. And there's no doubt that they're, it's hard to quantify, because once they get out of the United States, you don't know anything about them. But let's put it this way. It's sufficiently worrisome that the Obama CFTC wanted to stop it. The international organization that governs regulators around the world has announced that they are very troubled by this. It's doubtless a very, very big problem. And the problem is we are likely, especially as I went through with you and your excellent questioning, we are now entering a period of increased debt, increased defaults in debt, and increased betting on whether those debts will be paid off. Those are the three premises of the 2008 meltdown. Dodd-Frank was intended to stop that. Now the banks claim they don't have to follow Dodd-Frank. So we are cruising for another bruising.
Well, again, and as you were saying that, should this collapse again, the U.S. taxpayer would be on the hook for it. There was a point in your paper that I thought was very disturbing, unfortunately, and that was that researchers found that for every $100,000 that Democratic representatives received from the financial industry, the odds were that they would break with the party's support for financial regulation. That increased by 13.9%. Now, you've been talking a lot about Republicans and the Trump administration, but it seems like all sides of the aisle are culpable in this.
Well, it's not completely culpable on the Democratic side, but you may have seen about 2 months ago, there was a bank deregulation bill that went through Congress to reduce capital requirements for banks. And 17 Democratic senators sided with the Republicans, thereby making the remaining Democrats unable to stop it through requiring a filibuster. Generally, for low-level regulation that's dangerous but not comprehensible, the more money given to Democrats, the more likely the Democrats are to support that. My own view on this is, and I think this has proved out, is once you start talking about helping four big United States banks who are sailing and succeeding, weathered the recession, came out stronger, there's enough anger that if it was identified as a policy proposal to help those four big banks, it would not pass even a Republican-controlled Congress. The problem we have with the issue we're discussing is it sort of has never risen on people's radar screens. Not a lot of people know about it. If they did, I feel confident something would be done. There is an avenue of relief in that state attorneys general have the ability under the commodities laws to bring federal district court actions to make policies comply with Dodd-Frank. This policy is clearly a slam dunk.
Okay, wait, I'm sorry. I have to get some clarification here.
Sure.
Because if it comes back to the states, Wall Street is in New York, so then wouldn't that all fall on our attorney general?
Yes, and had Schneiderman stayed in office, I think we would have been likely to get the support of the New York State Attorney General. But let me just emphasize, in the entire history of the commodities law, no state attorney general has ever brought such an action. Why is that? The commodities derivatives law are the most poorly understood of all the financial laws. The purpose of this paper was to make it clear how outrageous what is happening is, and to educate state attorneys general to bring these kinds of actions. Had Schneiderman stayed, I think we would have had a good chance of having him be a leader in this. Zephyr Teachout, who's one of the Democratic candidates for attorney general, wrote an op-ed 2 days ago.
Well, I was going to say we have several candidates, and this all definitely, I think, for our listeners should make this campaign all the more interesting and
it definitely
important
is.
To watch. Listen, I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Okay.
I'm Jenna Flanagan, and I've been speaking with Professor Michael Greenberger about his recent paper, Too Big to Fail Banks, Regulatory Alchemy.